On now. All right, what do you say we move on to something productive? So by now you have a handout. We're in our, I think this is the third week in the justice and righteousness thing. So today we're going to do something a little bit different. As much as we talk about action, today I think we're going to talk about thought and process more than we're going to talk about actual action. And part of what we talk about for the morning, I think, is going to be universally applicable to anything. When we get into this, is anybody familiar with left of bang, that phrase and what it means? Left of bang? Okay, well, good. Then there's going to be some, what I think will be very helpful material for us all this morning. Applies to almost every area of life. It's a military phrase, and it comes out of military training, but it's really universally applicable here. But before we get into that, here's the basic theme for the morning, in case somehow in the process we get lost in the weeds. There is so much to do. Would any of you disagree with the fact that there is a lot of injustice in this world, one way or another? Can we all agree on that? Okay, so if we can all agree that there's a lot of injustice, that's one question. Here's the next one. Can we mostly agree that most of us are pretty busy already? Anybody have a few spare hours? Right, it's really tough, isn't it? So if we're mostly busy and there's an incredible amount of injustice that already exists in the world, then where do we apply the limited resources that we have if we wish to make a difference? I mean, a good way to phrase this, I found a quote this week. It's on midway down the front page there. And it says, "We can't do everything at the same time, but we can do one thing at a time." So the question becomes, what is the one thing that we might be able to do? Have you ever faced this dilemma? I see so many opportunities, I don't know which one to seize. I see so many problems, I don't know which one I should fix. Maybe I see so many chores around my house, I don't know which one to do. And in the process, I do none. Right? So this morning, I hope we're going to look at our own lives. And we're going to look at the situations that we might have influence on. And we're going to leave here with a little bit less guilt if we had any to begin with. Have you ever carried around a little bit of guilt because you thought you should do more and you couldn't? Well, I think that's debilitating too. So, a few big ideas here. And we're going to start with these couple of scriptures. We're going to read them. And I want you to then keep them as part of the repertoire for the conversation for the morning. So the first one is, "Good and upright is the Lord, therefore he instructs sinners in the way. He leads the humble in what is right and teaches the humble his way. All paths of the Lord are steadfast love and faithfulness for those who keep his covenant and his testimony." So there's kind of a progression that takes place there. So we start with, "Good and upright is the Lord, therefore he instructs sinners in his way." Now, it would be good, it would be natural for God to instruct righteous people, right? I mean, after all, who are the people that are most likely to receive God's wisdom? Righteous people. Who are the people that are most likely to be a captive audience for God's wisdom? People who are already interested in what God has to say, don't you agree? Have you ever thought, maybe you never said these words, but have you ever thought about someone, what's the use of saying anything to that person? He's probably not going to listen anyway. I'm seeing a lot of blank stares this morning. Am I speaking English? Am I the only person who has ever in his life thought, this person could really use some advice, some counsel, but I've watched his life and it doesn't seem as if he'd listen to it anyway? Everything that I've ever heard him say, everything that I've watched him do, suggests to me that everything that I would say or do on his behalf would be a waste of my time. Okay, I guess I'm the only one who has ever thought that. Maybe I should just rework the whole script for the morning. I don't know.
Think that every day.
Thank you. So you and I are in it alone. Where you and I.
I don't believe that.
Well, so the first thing is, if we're going to use God and His methods of dealing with people as a pattern for our own lives, in other words, if we want to demonstrate godly behavior, to act as sons of God, then it seems that we have to not only instruct those who are wise and interested. Listen, here's the next part of it. He leads the humble in what is right and teaches the humble His way. Now, it's not hard to teach a humble person, is it? That's the easy part. That's almost the enjoyable part. Have you ever had a person who said, you know, I'm not sure what to do. Do you have any thoughts, any ideas? Maybe you're a parent and once in your parental career, one of your children has come to you and said, what do you think I should do? That was humor. Wow, you guys are all like, is everybody awake here today? So that's the easy part. So I want you to see this. God not only is interested in teaching the people who are easy to teach, God is not only interested in instructing the people who are easy to instruct, He starts with the tough people. And He continues to send a voice and a representative even to the people who are least likely to listen. Because God, it seems, is optimistic about humanity. Then He leads the humble in what is right and teaches the humble His ways. And then we see, for all those who follow His ways, all the paths of the Lord are steadfast love and faithfulness for those who keep His covenant and testimonies. So what's the byproduct of this? God can point to people who are following His way, and He can use the example of people who are already following His way, and then use that example and point to and say to those who are the sinners in this phrase, and say, see, life would go better for you if you would do it this way. So the question for us who are hopefully humble and willing to follow God's advice is, could anybody else look at our life and say, it seems to be working well when that man follows God? I would like to emulate that type of behavior. It seems to go well for him. Now, there's a reason for this. You and I have a tendency to think that words don't matter. That if you want to get something done, actions are what are necessary. I know I've felt that. I want to go do something. I want to go fix something. I want to go save the world or whatever it is. Can you save the world with words? That's kind of a trick question. Did we not already establish that there's so much injustice in the world that we don't know where to begin? How many of you think there's enough resources in the world to solve all the injustice problems the way the world exists right now? There might be, right? But they're reallocated. They'd need to be grossly reallocated, wouldn't they? Have you ever observed this? Have you ever observed a problem that was addressed and fixed, and within a decade it's right back to where it was? It doesn't matter whether it's the room that your kid cleaned, or whether it's something of a little bit more profound nature, right? Like maybe it was an area in the inner city and there was a big initiative and we're going to clean it up and we're going to make it safe and we're going to fix the windows and we're going to remove the graffiti and we're going to make it better, and if we make it better, then surely the people will take care of it. And what's it look like 10 years later? Well, why? See, because, and remember that we're building a case here. There's an incredible amount of injustice and difficulty and problem in the world. We've already acknowledged that each of us is busy. We've already acknowledged then that if we're going to make any dent in the problems of the world, that we need to be very careful about the way we allocate our time. And yet we seem to think that words don't matter. So I'm going to ask you another question, and it's one we've talked about endlessly here, so you should be able to give me an answer. What's the starting point for all of our actions?
Inspiration.
Which? Okay. In general, most universal, what is the starting point of every action?
Desire.
A thought. A simple thought. I should this. I'd like to do that. I wonder if it would be good to do this. What informs your thinking? Whatever informs your thinking will inform your actions. So if you want to get at the heart of an issue, is it possible then we need to start at the heart of people. That it doesn't do any good to fix things outwardly if we haven't fixed things inwardly, because in a matter of time, it's only going to be right back where it was. And if we could just change a little bit of heart issue, then perhaps other people would become our allies. See, because one thing maybe that we didn't touch is that there's an awful lot of people that aren't even interested in solving the world's problems. They're just preoccupied with their own. As a matter of fact, there might have been a time in your own life when you were just preoccupied, but you didn't give a rip about anybody else's problems. Or even if you did, you were pretty confident that you didn't have enough time to do anything, and you were preoccupied with your own problems. So, my premise here is this. One of the things that I believe we need is more allies. Do you remember the town hall meeting the other... Why, that sun is annoying. The town hall meeting the other... Right? There was an awful lot of frustration expressed. There was an incredible amount of someone should do something expressed. Over and over, systematically, it was a judge that was the MC, right? She had to keep coming back and reminding people that if you have a moment at the microphone, you need to express an objective, a plan, something that you would like to do, not just vent your frustrations. There's an incredible amount of frustration in the world, but there's very little in the way of understanding about how to address the problems. As a matter of fact, at the end of the evening here, as important as I suspect that first meeting was, at the end of the evening, I was more convinced than ever that we're fixing the wrong problem. Like, over and over and over again, we talked about what to do with people, and I'm kind of like getting ahead of myself here, but we talked about people who were already in the thick of the problem. How do we help the people who are already in the thick of the problem? Do you know, I don't believe, honestly, there was 10 comprehensive statements made about, well, what if we helped the people who weren't in the problem yet? What if we properly addressed the problem before it was a problem? And so we can go right down to this part way down the front page here. Prevention is cheaper than remediation. That, we know this, right? How many of you, when you were 16 or 17, had a car that you knew you should take care of it better, but you kind of didn't? And you avoided a few of those things that you probably should have done to take care of your car. How many of you, after the fact, learned that it would probably have been cheaper to have done the small things to your car before they needed to be done than wait until after there was a big problem? Right? Well, if we do that with cars, do you suspect we do that with other things in life? I kind of think we do. Why do we do that? I'm convinced it's this. I'm convinced in part it's ignorance. Part of it is laziness, but part of it is ignorant. Why are we quick to feed starving people? But we're not as quick to address food source needs. We're not as quick to help people with the problem that got them to where they are to begin with. Because big problems are obvious, and we rush in to fix big problems. We rush in to fix the flooded out situation, right? We rush in to help the hurricane victims. Why didn't we spend 20 years evaluating the levee situation in New Orleans instead of spending 5 years or 10 years rebuilding afterwards?
Band-aid was easier.
See, to address core issues that cause injustice requires a more systematic, thoughtful approach. It's not glamorous. It doesn't shout for attention. And what if that's true about a lot of things? And where does all that begin? It begins with a different way of thinking. That's why I said that we need to begin with a different way of thinking. Scott.
You're right on the money with that concept, because most people are so self-absorbed, they are blind to the world's issues and potential issues beyond their own self. And once the crisis occurs, they can't help but see it. So when you say about addressing issues before they occur, it takes a lot of vision, it takes a lot of compassion, it takes a lot of your eyes open to the world's needs instead of my needs. And I don't think most people are there today. We are so overwhelmed with whatever it is that we got ourselves into. We got to get ourselves out of our bucket so we can see the world. So most people are so far in their own little rut, their own trench, they don't even have the ability to see the potentials in life, let alone have ideas how to prevent.
And if you go ahead,
I can directly relate to that with the like foster care. We have kids in our house all the time, and that's kind of attacking, helping out after the fact that the kids have already been through so much trauma and everything. But at the same time, we could easily forget our own kids and not give them the attention that they need and build them up. So we have to constantly refocus and think about that in the forefront of our lives and build our kids up as well as help these other kids. I can directly relate. Trying to not be so self-absorbed that they're just focusing on, trying to help and do the big problem and, hey, we're doing foster care. And, some people can take that and, enjoy the attention of it, but we're anyone who tries to say anything like that, we're letting them know that, hey, this is for God. We're trying to glorify God and help the widows and orphans. And at the same time, we're trying to, make our family better. So we pray about it all the time. We talk about why we're doing it with our kids. We try to build them up.
Boy, if you're going to be here next week, you need to hold that thought. Next week, we're going to look at Legacy from the Manly Man book. You expressed a very thoughtful idea there.
He hit right on it, and it's the same in the macro world or the micro world. Is we all have resource issues. There's only so much of us, only so much time. So at home, you've got to divide your time. What attention should I pour tonight into the fix the kitchen cabinet or into my kid's heart? There's a real time issue, and on the world scale, it's the same thing. And part of the reason in both world economic models and in business models, there's this squeaky wheel. It's the oil that goes on because we can't fix it all, so we'll fix the loudest. Is it the most effective way? No way. It's a lot cheaper to teach a country to grow their own rice than for us to grow it and ship it.
Mm-hmm.
However, and I'll stop with this, you have the heart issue there. Well, we'd rather grow and sell it to them because we can profit. We teach them the fish, we can't make anybody sell the fish. So from that standpoint, it's unbiblical. So it goes right back to what you were saying, the heart issue. Which goes right back to your first statement of every word we speak, every single action we do is the one thing we can do to weigh in. If there's anything we do, we're weighing in one way or another. You're going towards, decay, or you're going towards building up. So we're best to know well.
So one final thought on this before we move on. If we're fixated and preoccupied with crisis management, and you'll see what I mean in a moment, because as soon as we get into this left of bang stuff, this is really going to come alive for you. If we're constantly fixated on crisis management, how much time and energy is left to do anything preemptive? To go to the other side and to do preventative stuff so that we don't get to crisis? And so at times, it would seem like the most heartless thing you could do is abandon the need that is right there in front of you that needs immediate action because it's the squeaky thing. It would seem heartless and cruel to abandon that and go to look for preemptive measures so that the next generation doesn't have to do that. But if you don't ever take any time on the prevention side, you're always going to be in crisis management. It's not sustainable. And I suppose that's true in a household as well, right? It's not only, as you said, true on the macro scale. It's very true on the micro. All right, let's read a couple of scriptures. And then we're going to get into this other material. So one of them right here, right underneath the prevention is cheaper than remediation. You don't have to turn anywhere. It's right on your page there. The ear that listens to life-giving reproof will dwell among the wise. Whoever ignores instruction despises himself, but he who listens to reproof gains intelligence. The fear of the Lord is instruction in wisdom, and humility comes before honor. So the gist of these two verses is this: if you can instruct a person in how to be wise, he's less likely to need remediation help. If you can instruct a person in how to better have... As a matter of fact, John and I had a good conversation the other Thursday night after the town hall meeting. We both kind of like independently arrived at the same conclusion. You know what's missing in typical culture is some basic life skills instruction. There's an incredible number of people that arrive at adulthood without a repertoire of basic life skills that they understand. Do this or this will happen. Don't do that because this will happen. So if we turn loose and think of this is only going to get worse. I don't want to sound like I'm really negative, but it's like if a couple of generations ago that led up to where we are now, there were usually men in the home, and here's where we are today. And now we say that, what, with something like 40% of moms have their first kid and there's no male in the home, or at least not a married male. Well, if we're in this bad a situation now as a result of previous family models, do you think it's going to get better two generations out? If right now we're sowing the seeds for what that's going to be like? See, it can only get worse, I think. So if we don't turn this around and if we don't start to give some life skills instruction and help young men and women to understand how to live their lives better, we're just ensuring that this is going to go on and on and on. And yet we face that challenge. And here's the challenge. Wise people, humble people, as the first verse said, are eager to hear. They're eager to learn. The reality that we face is there's a lot of people that aren't eager to learn. The ones that most need the help are the least likely to listen. And I have a feeling that you probably encounter that at times. Go ahead.
There's a really good chapter. I was reading ahead a little bit.
Oh, you're not allowed to do that.
I'm going to read it twice.
Okay.
There's a really good chapter about learning.
Excuse me. My friend Scott can't get me more coffee. So while you're talking, I'm going to have to get my own coffee.
It's all about this generation. Certain men will go after that, will try to acquire knowledge constantly. And there's other men, like, and it seems to be more common now, to just wait for it to come to you. Just learn what you need to get your job on, whatever. Just being lazy, really. And I think that's a huge difference. A lot of people, like you said, a lot of people don't even know the basic life skill because they're waiting for someone to teach them that. They're not trying to acquire that themselves, they're not going after it.
Which kind of begs the question, how do you instill in someone the desire to want to learn? Where does that come from? Good. The question is, have they ever been opened?
We play a hot locker before. We stand
up. All right, let's turn over to Luke 12, I guess we'll start. Luke 12 there, but what we're going to do is we're actually going to back up and we're going to look at part of Luke 11, which kind of like takes us into an understanding of what's going on here. So if you want to turn over to Luke, the 11th chapter, we'll start at the 37th verse. While Jesus was speaking, a Pharisee asked him to dine with him, so he went in and reclined at the table. So he gets a dinner invitation, he goes in, and I know you've heard this before, but typically a dinner like this would have been one where everybody sits around, there's a lot of dialogue, certainly there's food, but there's a lot of deep discussion. Now, knowing what we know about Jesus, here's what I believe. I believe there's parts of this event that aren't recorded for us. I can't imagine Jesus being invited to dinner and within 5 minutes saying to his dinner guests, "Now you Pharisees cleanse the outside of the cup and the dish, but inside you were full of greed and wickedness." I mean, that just doesn't seem like the thing that you would say to the person who just invited you to dinner. So there's probably some conversation that leads up to this. But then he goes on, "You fools, did not he who made the outside make the inside also? But give as alms those things that are within, and behold, everything is clean for you. But woe to you, Pharisees, for you tithe mint and rue and every herb and neglect justice and the love of God." So in essence, what he's saying is, and we have to understand that these Pharisees, and he gets into the lawyers, or what we'd say the scribes, the teachers of the law, in just a moment. But these are the people who set the example for what it should look like to be a godly person. So that anyone in society, if anyone in common society, if any one of the commoners, as it were, has a question about, "I wonder what it looks like to be one of God's people," who are they going to turn to? They're going to turn to these Pharisees, and they're going to assume, well, if I want to be more godly, if I want to be find myself in favor with God, this is what I'm going to look like. And so now you see, and this is why Jesus is so upset with this. He said, all you are is posers. You're worried about what you look like. You're worried about these trivial, perfunctory laws, half of which you've made up. But you're actually not worried about compassion and justice and righteousness. But woe to you, Pharisees, and this is where he says it, for you tithe mint and rue and every herb and neglect justice and the love of God. These you ought to have done, in other words, the former, if you choose to tithe these things, these incidentals, which they weren't even obligated to, these you ought to have done without neglecting the others. Jump down a verse or two. One of the lawyers answered him and says, "Teacher, in saying these things, you insult us also." That kind of seems obvious, doesn't it? So Jesus says, "Woe to you lawyers, for you load people with burdens hard to bear, and you yourselves do not touch the burdens with one of your fingers." So what's he saying? So while the Pharisees live out the model, this is what it would look like to be godly, the teachers of the law, they spell it out. This is what you need to do. So the Pharisees show, the teachers of the law teach, this is what you do. So it's the 1-2 punch. And so how do you feel at the end of that? How do you feel if the model that you look up to, you can't attain to, and the laws that you're given to follow, you can't quite reach? Just think about your state of mind. Every day, you're invited to be godly, but every day, the standard is set that's too high for you to reach. Visually, you see it lived out before you, and the commandments that you're given, the things that you're supposed to follow, are beyond your ability to do. You don't have the time, you don't have the money, you don't have... Have you ever felt as if the life you lived seemed to be in conflict with some teaching that you got? Well, that sounds like great theory, but if you lived in my shoes, you wouldn't be able to do this stuff. And what would be the torment that you would go through if that was the condition of your life, every day of your life? What would you start to think about yourself? I'll never be godly. I guess God will think of me as a second-class citizen. And I mean godly in the best of ways. I don't mean some uptight kind of like thing. I will never find favor with God because this is out of reach. So that might be the best way to describe it. What would it feel like to wake up every day, be concerned with having God's love and affection and favor, and know that you could never reach it, or believe that you could never reach it? So... And I don't know that this is true for anybody in this room, but you can imagine what would it feel like if your own biological father. If you grow up in a home where favor with your father was always just out of reach and you could never achieve it. You were always hoping for the loving comment from your dad, but you never got it. And it's kind of that way with these people that he's describing. Jesus is standing up for these people, these common people. Listen, you're making it so that it is impossible for them to feel the love and the affection and the favor of God. All right, so we jump into chapter 12 now. In the meantime, so while this conversation is going on, there's a crowd gathering. In the meantime, when so many thousands of people had gathered together that they were trampling one another, he began to say to his disciples, "Beware of the leaven of the Pharisees, which is hypocrisy. Nothing is covered up that will not be revealed, or hidden that will not be known." All right, now that's a whole separate teaching, so we're not going to get into that. "I tell you, my friends, do not fear those who kill the body and afterward have nothing more that they can do, but I will warn you to whom to fear. Fear him who after he is killed has the authority to cast into hell." So now Jesus has moved from talking to the people who were supposed to set the example and teach the example, and he's moved out into the population. And in the population, he says this: understand who you should fear. That's the essence of it. Understand who you should honor, we'll say. We'll substitute the word for the word fear, we'll substitute the word honor. Who should you hold in greatest esteem? Who should you use as your role model? Should it be God or should it be man? If you have to pick, should you seek to gain the favor of man or should you seek to gain the favor of God? And he gives them a powerful reason why it would be in their best interest to seek the favor of God. All right, so he's in the middle of this really heavy teaching. Now I want you to jump over to verse 13. Someone in the crowd said to him, "Teacher, tell my brother to divide the inheritance with me." But he said to him, "Man, who made me a judge or an arbiter over you?" So, in the middle of this really deep discussion, what's the guy's concern? Well, his inheritance, but what does he perceive? There's a real question here. I've been unjustly treated. It doesn't seem that this is right. You seem like the kind of a guy that would really care about this. Why don't you step in and fix it? What's Jesus' response? Who am I to do that? Now, here's the paradox. Who is he to do that? I mean, ultimately, if he is God, he certainly could, right? He would have the authority. He wouldn't need anyone's permission to step into that conflict. But what does God say? Anybody? Look, you don't. This is not an answer that you even need to have in your head. Just look at the text. What does God say? He says, "No, you fix the problem." How empowering is that? And what does that say to us? Just think about that for a moment. Have you ever prayed to God and said that God and asked God to do something about a problem? God, you fix this. God, would you please take care of that? God, would you address that? And what's God saying? Yeah, you guys get into the middle of it and do something about it. So what are the guy's options? He feels that he's been poorly treated as far as the inheritance goes. So usually the oldest son gets at least half. It would not have been completely uncommon for the oldest son to get everything, so then the younger son or multiple sons would have gotten a lot less to divide amongst themselves or even nothing. So there's a resentment that's built up. How long does resentment last? That way, just think about this. Make this a real guy, not just a story. Make this a real guy. So here he is, and it says there's a crowd. What prompts a man in the middle of a crowd of people who are listening to serious teaching to stand up and shout this out?
Should have something. And Jesus goes on to say that it's not by what it's in possessions. But that, in the Bible, you read about so-and-so had so many thousands of sheep and all this. I don't care about sheep. But now, let somebody read that I got a new Mustang or something, or a new house or a big screen TV. Jesus doesn't get involved in the argument that's circling around the reed. And I don't think he's saying, who am I to judge? He is the right one to judge. But in those things that aren't unrighteous, he judges the heart.
Ultimately, what is he asking people to do? Because this is profound. What this guy is asking Jesus to do is step into the problem and make the problem go away. What Jesus is saying is, your understanding is going to be the source of making the problem go away. Either for you to be content, or you to find some means of reconciling with the person whom you feel has gotten the majority of the inheritance. Because here's what we like to think. God should step in, and there's some really bad people in the world, and God, have you ever heard God, where was God when this happened? Well, here's the problem. And this is why heart understandings matter so much, and it's why justice will never be established until hearts are truly changed. If you took out of the world all the really, really bad people, let's say that there were 5% of all the world's population that was the really, really bad people, and you would think, well, if God would just take the really, really, really bad people out of the world, then a lot of the justice issues would resolve themselves. But who'd be left?
The sort of bad people.
And immediately, the sort of bad people, that they weren't the top 5%, they were like the 90 to 95% people. You with me? Then who'd be the worst people in the world? They would be. So now what's God going to do? Because there's still injustice in the world. God, if you would just wipe out the 90 to 95%, maybe the problem would go away. Okay, now who's left? Here's the point. If God were to fix injustice the way we sometimes would like Him to, there'd be nobody left. Because if there was only two people left in the world, I guarantee you that sooner or later there would be injustice. Remember Cain and Abel? How many people did there need to be in the world for injustice to take place? And a mom and a dad. So at least four that we know of. But it doesn't take many people for injustice to prevail. So as much as we think that God should step in to fix the problem, God already knows, a loving God already knows, that He cares about people so much, He wants us to learn to resolve problems and act righteously and act justly. And if we don't do that, no amount of God's intervention is going to fix the problem. And I know that sounds wrong. God can't fix the issues that reside within our hearts if we're not willing to let our hearts be restored and repaired. So it all starts on the inside.
The individual answer is, everybody worse than me.
It is.
It's going to be different for everybody.
Yeah. But if instead of God, take care of that, fix that, tell my brother to do this, every human heart has to respond with, what can I do? Every single human heart. And so when we say, well, we need to step in and... Have you ever had a confrontation with someone who was doing something wrong and you knew they should stop and you tried to confront them and tell them that they should stop? How does that usually go? I mean, honestly, how does it usually go? It doesn't usually go well, right? I mean, there's the off time when it does, but for the most part, people who are set on doing something wrong are going to continue in doing something wrong.
Yesterday I got a sign from one.
What?
Yesterday I got a sign from one.
Oh.
It also speaks of we let our situation drive or dictate the condition of our heart. Like this guy. Instead of Jesus turning around and being told, change your heart. And if your heart's changed, if you're about money, suddenly that doesn't matter. It wasn't about the inheritance. Where that guy can say, I'm okay without having it have the money.
Let me give you a jump up a little bit on the, I think it's the first page. I came across this verse, a couple of verses this week. Give ear, O heaven, and I will speak, and let the earth hear the words of my mouth. Now this is Moses talking. May my teaching drop as rain, my speech distill as dew. Like gentle rain upon the tender grass and like showers upon the herb. For I proclaim the name of the Lord, ascribe greatness to his name. Now the meat of what I want to focus on is in that center section there. May my teaching... I just posed a question. Have you ever tried to confront someone who is doing something that you believe is wrong? Now how do we usually confront people? I mean, it's hard, right? Sometimes, I don't like confrontation. But I have to say that when I do confront, I usually don't do it well. Because by the time I have built up the nerve to confront somebody about something rather than just avoid it, I'm really primed to have a confrontation. And it's not really a righteous confrontation by the time that I'm ready to have the confrontation. Now, maybe I'm alone in the room in that, but I'll assume that maybe once or twice. Right? Listen to these words again. May my teaching drop as rain, my speech distill as dew, like gentle rain upon the tender grass and like showers upon the herb. So it's describing something. Now, I grew up on a farm, so I'm going to give you a little bit of a farm analogy here, and you can all make fun of me afterwards for that. But when ground is soft, when ground is well-nourished, when ground is reasonably moist, believe it or not, it's easiest for the ground to soak up more moisture. In other words, when ground already has a little moisture, it's easier for it to soak up more. When ground is hard, water runs right off of it. So the one thing that a farmer never wants is to have a long dry period followed by a torrential rain. Because the rain mostly doesn't soak in. It's a complete waste. It just runs right off. But it does more than just run right off. Look at this phrase right here. It describes what kind of grass? Tender grass. And herbs are very fragile, incidentally. So what it's saying is that when your teaching, when your confrontation is a torrent, not only does most of it run off, but what do you suspect happens to the tender blades of grass that are still surviving and the fragile herbs that are still growing? And we've all seen that, literally, right? If it finally does start to wash, it washes a gully and it washes everything away. And it all runs away. The ground is not better for it, and what little life was there is now probably damaged or destroyed. I found this to be particularly insightful. How do we gradually transform hearts? With light rain. With light teaching. As a matter of fact, ideally, like if you have any outside plants, outside flowers, or maybe your wife has a few flowers, how often do you water those flowers in the summer? Probably every day. A little bit of rain, a little bit of water every day is ideal. Trying to have this monumental confrontation where you break out the fire hose and water the pansies from the fire hydrant doesn't work. What happens? It just blows them all away. And that's sometimes what we do. So I think this is good universal wisdom for dealing with children, for dealing with coworkers, for dealing with people whose behavior you'd like to change. And I have to say, I need this verse as much as any of you in the room, probably more than any of you in the room, because I know the way I confront people. You know, Scott, you could just turn away if you're going to laugh. You don't need to agree with me so much right now. When I'm in the midst of confessing my sins, I don't need your amen at the end of it. All right, so let's come back to Luke 13, or Luke 12. We're going to start at the 13th verse. Hopefully you're still there. All right, but now we're going to get into this story. The land of a rich man produced plentifully. And he thought to himself, what shall I do? For I have nowhere to store my crop. So instead of reading through the whole thing, let's just break it down. The land of a rich man produced plentifully. So what do we know about the man?
Successful.
He's a successful person. How would a person have measured wealth at that time? Anybody?
Compared to everyone else.
What?
Compared to everyone else.
Well, compared to everyone else, but what would have been... So, for instance, the measure of wealth would not have been... You know, a Mustang's a pretty lame aspiration. If you're going to go for a car, you may as well go for a car. So, the guy would not... Today, we might say he would have been the guy with the Porsche in the driveway. And the driveway would have led up to a really nice house. And the guy would have had plenty of bucks in the bank and all that. How was wealth assessed back then? How would a person be deemed to be wealthy then?
Livestock.
Livestock would be one thing. Certainly land. Right? You know who got the worst land? The poorest people. Because if you were wealthy, you were in a position to acquire the best land. So this man is wealthy not only because he might have some tangible assets. This man is wealthy because he has land that is capable of producing a good crop. And he's already wealthy, which means it would seem he's a wise man, wouldn't it? It would seem he's the kind of a man that you would aspire to be. And so he thought to himself, what shall I do? For I have nowhere to store my crop. What else do we know about the man? Let me read another verse, and then we'll be able to see. And he said, I will do this. I will tear down my barns and build larger ones. And there I will store all my grain and my goods. So now what do we know about the wealthy man? How else is he wealthy? He has surplus. In other words, last year's crop is not gone. There's so much of last year's and the year before's and the year before that. And incidentally, grain doesn't deteriorate or go bad that quickly. It can be stored. Remember the story of Joseph? He stores grain for multiple years so it can be redistributed. Okay, so he already has enough that the barns are already full of what he has. And he's got a crop in the field and he finds himself in this dilemma. And so his answer is, I will tear down my barns and build larger ones, and there I will store, and there you can see it, all my grain, meaning both the new grain and the grain that's already in the barns, and my goods. And then I will say to my soul, soul, you have ample goods laid up for many years. Relax, eat, drink, and be merry. And then God says to him, full this night your soul is required of you, and the things you have prepared, whose will they be? All right, now we know the end of the story, but here's my question in light of this. Remember what we've said. None of us has the resources to make things right. None of us has all the time. None of us has all that. And there's what seems to be an insurmountable amount of injustice going on in the world. What is this man's concern? Himself. Here's a question. Could a man like that help with problems of injustice in the world? You bet he could, right? If you and I rush out to fix the injustice in the world, and we spend all of our time dealing with the crisis, do we ever get around to inviting people like him into considering how they might help? His focus is all about him. And I'm making this very real right now. And I know Jesus is using this to point out what is an individual's heart concern. My question is, can we transform a person's heart? Can we be partners with God in helping a human heart to be transformed so that now that person, instead of being neutral, becomes part of the solution that we're trying to accomplish? Do you think it would be easier to accomplish the solution that we're trying for if we had this man as an ally instead of on the sidelines? And given that the man is influential in the community, and we know that because he's wealthy, what would the influence of a man who once was... Do you remember the Zacchaeus story? Anybody? The short dude with the big bucks? whose heart is transformed. And then he says he's going to... What do you think was the example in that community of what Zacchaeus did? Do you think it made other people look and say, maybe this Jesus guy has got something I want to look at, because obviously this guy thought that Jesus was more valuable than his wealth. Maybe there's something to this thing. Maybe I want to look into it too. Why does Jesus single out Zacchaeus? I mean, there's a crowd of people in town. I know Zacchaeus is the only short guy hanging in a tree, or at least he's the only one that's written about there. But why does he single him out? He seems the most improbable of people to single out. A lot of people knew who Zacchaeus was.
He displayed a true heart of repentance. Especially with his hell and return with the second fold. Whoever had to fold.
He was also willing to see for the hardness.
Okay.
A little guy, he's got to climb a tree.
Okay, so he knows something is missing. Right? Zacchaeus knows something is missing. How do we create an awareness, a hunger in people to say there's something missing? I'd like to be a part of something different. All right. So we're going to put a... Now, let's read the next parable before we get into this. We still got a little bit of time. So we're going to turn over to Luke 16 now. Before we actually read anything, let's do a little bit of background. So, the chapter before this is the parables of lostness. The entire 15th chapter of Luke is devoted to how God responds to lost people. So it's the lost sheep, then the lost coin, then finally the prodigal son. So chapter 15 of Luke is focused on how does God turn into the needs of people. Chapter 16 seems to come all of a sudden out of the blue, but in fact, it seems, if you study it a little bit more carefully, to be how do people respond to God? What should be God or people's response to God? We've seen in chapter 15 how does God respond to people. So now we turn it around, and in chapter 16 we say, how do we want people to respond to God? He also said to the disciples, there was a rich man who had a manager, and charges were brought to him that this man was wasting his possessions. Okay, so you get the picture. The rich man. Now we can clearly see, when you read the whole story, that the wealthy person is God. The wealthy person has a manager, and who is the manager? Well, it could be any of us. And so it says, and charges were brought to him that this man, this manager, was wasting the owner's possessions. And he called him and said to him, what is this that I hear about you? Turn in the account of your management, for you can no longer be a manager. Now incidentally, if you are a perceptive Pharisee or a perceptive teacher of the law right now, you probably had a good inclination, an inkling that this was about you. We are the managers, we're the stewards, we're the shepherds of God's resources, and God has now brought a charge against us that we're mismanaging His resources. And God has now saying, are you implying, and this might even be the question of the Pharisees to Jesus, it's not recorded here, but are you implying that we're going to lose our management position? Well, in fact, that's exactly what did happen ultimately. Turn in an account of your management, for you can no longer be manager. And the manager said to himself, what shall I do, since my master is taking the management away from me? I'm not strong enough to dig, and I'm ashamed to beg. So what's revealed there? What's the condition of the guy? And this is why it seems to me to be so obvious that there is a condition of talking about the religious establishment of the day. What's his condition? Basically, I'm not a man who has ever worked for a living. I don't identify with working people. I've never had to struggle or sacrifice myself. And I'm so filled with pride, I could never stoop to beg. And he said, I have decided what to do, so that when I am removed from my management, people may receive me into their houses. So summoning his master's debtors one by one, he said to the first, "How much do you owe my master?" And he said, 100 measures of oil. He said to him, "Take your bill and sit down and quickly write 50. Then to another, "How much do you owe?" And he said, 100 measures of wheat. And he said, "Take your bill and write 80. Do you see what's going on here? Do you understand what's going on here? So the manager knows the ledgers, and he goes to each person, and each person is in debt to the owner. And so what the manager does is figure, if I can get in the middle of this and I can get every person's debt removed, they're going to love me later because they have to pay the owner back much less. And that's going to put me in a very favorable position. Now, at first this seems like, what does this parable have to do with anything righteous? The master commended the dishonest manager for his shrewdness. "For the sons of this world are more shrewd in dealing with their own generation than the sons of light. And I tell you, make friends for yourselves by means of unrighteous wealth, so that when it fails, you may be received into eternal dwellings." What's Jesus saying? Anybody? Okay, let me get the conversation started. He said, everyday people in the world, he says, they seem to know how to use wealth to their advantage. You, the people of righteousness, you don't seem to understand it the same way. He said, but what if instead of chasing after money for the sake of money, what if you used your wealth to influence people towards God's kingdom? Because later on, when you have lost your position here on earth, which is only temporary anyway, when you find yourself in the kingdom, and as their understanding of it was, it would have been the bosom of Abraham, when you find yourself there, you're going to be welcomed there by an awful lot of people whose wealth you have used to influence to get them there. Your wealth you use to make a difference. Does this make sense? So he says, buy friends for the kingdom. Take your money and use it well. Be shrewd with your money. How do you do that? Again, we influence people's hearts. We use money to influence people's hearts because people's hearts do what? My understanding informs my thinking. My thinking informs my action. I can't act in a different way until I think in a different way. I can't think in a different way until I have different understandings. So as much as it seems as if it's the wrong place to start, the place to start to fix injustice is not on the outside. The place to start to fix injustice is in people's hearts and understandings. Because if you and I, exactly like I described God, if we as God's representatives simply try to address the outward circumstances, we will spend the rest of our lives fixing problems. And if it's not like the ghetto, if we could actually fix a problem and it would stay fixed, which is improbable, given that there's so much unrighteousness in the world, if we could actually fix a problem and it would stay fixed, there would just be that many more problems to fix. The only way that we can ever fix injustice is to transform people's hearts. All right. I want you to hold the principles of those two parables while we look at this. So here's the idea. Left of bang. About 2007, the Marine Corps discovered that they had a real problem, specifically in Iraq, because there were so many soldiers being killed and seriously injured due to improvised explosives. And they felt powerless. Like they went over there to fight, and they went over there to fight conventional war, and they found themselves the victims of all of these clever guerrilla tactics and guerrilla explosives. And so a couple of people began to ask the question, Could we equip people stateside? Could we train people stateside so that before they left, they were better equipped with a set of skills that would help them to detect what was on the ground there so they wouldn't just walk blindly into traps and step onto explosives? In other words, could we be proactive instead of addressing the issue by building more hospitals to treat more wounded people? Could we keep people from being wounded? And so they developed this four-step process. This is four steps of awareness. Now, I want you to think about your own life right now. I said this would be very instructive, and I believe it will. So, phase one of awareness is what they call white phase. And we're going to do this. And that means that you're alive. Okay, you got a pulse, you're living, you're breathing. White phase, you're not alert to anything. You're not looking for opportunities. To be in white phase is to be the wealthy guy with the crop problem. He doesn't have any idea about what's going on around him. He's concerned with his own life. He's concerned with his own living. That's why we use that as an example. So we move to the next phase. And the goal of this training was to move people out of white phase. In other words, they don't even know that they should be looking for something. Move them first to yellow phase. Yellow phase means that I'm alert. I know there's danger, and we're using the military example here. I know there's danger. I just don't know where the danger is coming from. But I've moved from being oblivious and just walking through life, just concerned with myself, to being highly alert and looking for what might be the threat. Now let's turn this around, because we're not here to deal with threats, we're here to deal with opportunities. So to deal with an opportunity, I say, I move from white phase, which means I'm interested only in myself, to yellow phase, which means I'm looking for an opportunity, but I don't know what the opportunity is. From yellow, we move to orange. Orange means that now I am alert, but I'm contained alert, which means I am aware of a particular threat. I've moved from clueless, I don't even know that there is a threat, to being alert to the fact that there is some threat, I just don't know what it is, to now orange, I am very specifically honed in on a specific threat. I know that this could be a problem, I just don't know where I'll find it. And we move from there to red phase. Can't even spell red. So red means now I have encountered the problem. I'm no longer looking for the problem. I'm dealing with the problem. The problem is right here in front of my face. It's revealed itself, and now I need to deal with it. These symbols will become meaningful in a moment. Now, if I don't handle the problem well in red phase, the final phase is black. So in black phase, we just take this and we just draw a straight line. So we get black, right? Black is now I'm no longer able to deal with the threat. I'm gone. Now here's the next thing that they discovered. So let's walk through these again. White means I'm not aware of anything. Yellow means I'm acutely aware of something. I just don't know what I should be looking for. Orange is I am specifically honed in a particular threat. Red means I am now addressing the threat. And black is I've failed to address the threat or I've lost to the threat. But here's why these symbols are important. When I am most alert is in the yellow phase. Surprisingly, when I move into orange phase, I'm so focused in on one threat that if another threat were to come from the outside, I'd probably fall victim to it. Because I am so keenly honed in on this one and looking for this opportunity that I might walk right by other opportunities. We move into red, and what's happened? I am so busy dealing with what has now been unleashed on me right here. I'm so in the middle of this that I'm completely unalert. I'm completely unguarded because I am so busy immersed in the doing. My alertness is going to nothing now. Are you tracking with me so far? Now, does anybody see the correlation to what happens when we get busy with life? So think about this. And this is one of the things why, one of the reasons why we sometimes feel guilty and we don't know why. Have you ever been challenged to do more? Ministry, service, something? And you say, well, I'd like to, but I'm not sure how. It is possible to get so into red in your life that you have no perception anymore. You're so busy dealing with the things that you have taken on that you have no time or no ability to do anything else. And when you try to do more, what happens? Yeah, you go black. That's it. Emotionally, you go black. You go flatlining. You don't have any interest in anything anymore, and you burn yourself out. So here's the question. Where are you in a ministry phase right now? And just think about this. I'm in this phase. They say the most alert a person is in yellow phase. The more keenly focused you are in one thing, the more oblivious you are to many things. When you get fully immersed in something, you're oblivious to everything else. How many of us as guys get so immersed in what we have to do every day, the commitments that we've already made, that we have nothing left? The purpose to my introducing this is not so we all feel guilty. The purpose is to say, take stock of your life. Are you already doing right now everything that you can do? Because the last thing that we want anyone to do is feel false guilt because we're calling them to do more when they're already in this. And you have to get out of this. Hopefully this will not last forever. This crisis that you're in the middle of fighting won't last forever. We're going to move on to the next phase of this now. Does anybody see how this makes sense in all of life? And it really applies specifically to some of these parables that we've looked at. We take the rich guy who's got the barns. How could we move him to a state of yellow? Where he started to look for opportunity around him. Remember, we're now going to flip this around. This is not danger. This is opportunity. Let this represent opportunity. How can we help this guy to look at opportunities? How can we help him to focus in on an opportunity? How can each of us help the rest of us to focus in on an opportunity? And then how do we seek help so that we are not so overwhelmed in here that something from the outside comes in and takes us black? I found it particularly interesting that they use these three phrases. So part of this, what they call Combat Hunter, that's the name of this course, is Combat Hunter. Everybody is divided into one of three categories. You're going to like this. Everybody is either a shepherd, they're sheep, or they're wolves in sheep's clothing. Now, this is military terminology. So what's a shepherd? That's these guys. These guys who are assigned to protect. And who are the shepherds assigned to protect? The sheep, which is the general population. The sheep are pretty much clueless. And finally, he said, there's the wolves in sheep's clothing. So in light of this, what they are trained to do is to be looking for the wolves in the sheep's clothing because they're the threat. There's three particular things that they focus on doing. Observation. Seeing what used to be missed and observing it, and this is critical, without being observed yourself. Now, I want to make this very practical because one of the things that we're looking at doing leading up to and then especially after the breakfast, one of the things that I'm kind of passionate about is helping single moms who are struggling with kids and need some help. They need some, let's say, dads in their lives at times. They need somebody to take their kids out and maybe invest a little bit in them. Remember what we talked about, that if I can do some prevention, I have less remediation to do later on. Come back to the town hall meeting. The number of children that don't have an important, significant male figure in their life that is coaching, mentoring, developing, loving on them, every one of them is set up for needing remediation later. But if we could do some early on prevention, maybe we could help stem that just a little bit. Scott.
This ties directly into a friend of mine's situation. He has a nephew, 17 years old, a couple months to be 18. For the past 2 years, especially, been in all sorts of trouble, drugs, stealing. Recently, just stole his grandfather's credit cards. Didn't know how to make a bunch of purchases, had his stuff delivered somewhere else, stole his car when he was in the hospital. All these things have taken place. And this kid's been through a lot of different interventions already. And went to Child Protective Services, and Child Protective Services said, he's so close to 18, he won't do anything about it. We have more important kids to deal with in the system, the younger kids. And then really what you're saying, that statement now resonates that there's hope for those younger kids to transform them into something positive. This one that's almost 18, he's so deep-rooted is bad ways. It's that you can't put a thumb on him in a couple of months anyway. He's his own man now. He's his own person. He can make his own rules. Consequently, he can suffer imprisonment or whatever else may come at 18. So, but I thought it was interesting that even Child Protective Services realize that you've got to target young, impressionable kids that you can change.
There's a greater possibility for a favorable outcome if you can intervene early on in the process. And think about it, is it easier to influence perhaps a 10-year-old than it is that 17 or 18-year-old? And the more time any of us, and we all know this to be true, we know it to be true in our own lives, the more time I invest in going in a particular direction, the harder it is to, we'll say, repent, which just means to turn around. The more time I have invested in going this direction, the more allies and acquaintances I have acquired in going this direction, the harder it is going to be for me to break path and go back in the opposite direction. I'm going to make this book recommendation. It's going to be in that list of 10 that we hand out, but the book is called Fearless. If you're a reader, you should get it. If you're not a reader, you should become one so that you can read it.
Is that Adam Brown?
It is. Are you a reader? You're a reader. Have you read the book? It's a good book, isn't it? Would you endorse it? Yeah. Buy it, read it. And one of the things about the story, and I'm not going to ruin the whole story, but one of the things about the story that impressed me so much, and part of the guy's testimony, part of his story, is a struggle with drugs. A real struggle with, I think it was crack. And again, no matter how much he wants to do the right thing, no matter how many allies are on his side, he wants to return to that. Even years into recovery, it still haunts him and dogs him, and he wants to return to that. There are certain things that once they get into a guy's life, he will have that to fight with for the rest of his life. And it just made me acutely aware of the struggles that a lot of people carry around throughout life. And boy, as much as it's possible, you want to do the prevention rather than have to do the intervention after all. Later on. Whatever. All right. So here's the thing. Observation. Seeing what used to be missed and observing it without being noticed yourself. Now, here's why I introduced the single moms. One of the things that we find in polite, comfortable society is no one wants to admit that they need help. Do you agree? Who wants to admit that I need somebody else's help? I don't like to admit that. Do you always want other people's help? Well, brother, you really need some help, so you're the exception to the rule. Amen. And this is why I say we need to become skilled. And remember, I'm taking this right out of this training material. We need to become skilled at observing situations without being observed. Yeah, you know this about research, that they say that when researchers do something, they want to be observing something without being detected as part of the sphere there, because the second that they are observing, it contaminates the evidence. Because their observation influences what the people are going to do. So if people know that you're watching, what are they going to look like? What do we all look like on a Sunday morning when we know somebody is watching?
Christians.
Yes, we do. And righteous and holy and happy ones at that, do we not? Now, I'll just throw this out here hypothetically. Has any one of you ever been a poser on a Sunday morning? Has any one of you ever had chaos going on in his life and you weren't sure if you were going to make it for the next week while you looked happy on Sunday morning? And so we need to become skilled observers of where there might be need and where the need might be trying to be hidden. This doesn't just apply to enemies. This applies to trying to help good people. The second thing, tracking, looking for small physical clues that something is happening or being done. Is there any evidence that this person could use some help? Is there any evidence that there is a deteriorating situation here? And finally, profiling, which is, and you can see this in the defensive mode here, observing the way people act. And the way it's phrased in this military school is that there's a certain collection of involuntary things that people do who are guilty or trying to do something. They fidget a little. Their eyes do something different. So in other words, what these Marines are taught is as they move through a crowd, where you don't know who is the enemy. It could be a grandfather. It could be a 10-year-old kid. You don't know who is the enemy. There's a certain collection of things that you look for in the faces and the mannerisms of the people that you're walking, the crowd that you're walking through, because there's a very small percentage of them that are going to reveal that they're perhaps up to something. So now we flip this in around and look for opportunity. Are there certain things that we can detect about people? So I don't want to profile people, although that's the word it uses here. Is there something, can we tell something about their dress? In other words, do they have nice clothes, but they're a little bit disheveled? Are things a little bit disorganized? Is there a little bit of chaos that's happening when they walk into church on Sunday morning? Are they a little bit standoffish? Are they a little aloof? Whatever it is. Is there something behind the I'm fine? Are they walking through our crowd and pretending to be fine, but there's little mannerisms about them that are indicating that they're anything but fine and that they desperately need some help? I'm just saying that maybe we need to become more astute about that. Because I believe that a lot of people hide the fact that they need help. What does it say about a mom or even about a family when their kids are in chaos? What do we perceive it to be said? I was not a good parent. If I was a good parent, I wouldn't have this problem. If I was a good parent, my kids wouldn't have turned out this way. If I just made more money, I wouldn't have this problem and I wouldn't be looking for another apartment to move into because I've been kicked out of my last one. If I this, if I that, if I the other thing. And maybe there's a certain amount of truth to that. But at this point in the person's life, it's their life and it's also the lives perhaps of their children. So we can either do 10 pounds of remediation, or maybe if we're wise about this, we can really have some influence for exerting justice in the world by doing a few pounds of preventive maintenance. Okay, wow, right on time. It's almost 9 o'clock. I did good.